Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. And welcome back to my own self. I've been away for the past three of my biweekly programs because I was on a book leave. To finish a book I'll tell you about this fall, it's on the spiritual dynamic in modern art, which is a much-denied subject in the professional art world, rather like kryptonite. Not for the artist, but for all those folks around them. Anyway, later for that. So, when I left off here 6 weeks ago, there was a lot of talk in Washington and the media and state legislatures about raising the minimum wage to $10.10, or somewhere around there. There wasn't much talk around the fact that this is a dire situation that is situated within a larger one, and that is the wage theft that has gone on for the past 40 years, really intensely for the past 30 years, especially during the big boom time in the 1990s and up to 2008, when corporate profits really swelled, but wages and most salaries did not share in that growth. In other words, the owners, the boards, they just kept the workers' share of the profit, what normally would have been seen as the incremental increase reflecting this great expansion going on. And I see that really as a continuum from 1952 with the Taft-Hartley Act to start busting the unions, and once the unions were pretty much sidelined, the folks just decided to stop paying the workers pretty much anything in terms of the increase in cost of living. So that all worked pretty well because at the same time, the tax rate was steadily decreased year by year for the corporations and for the very wealthy. Well, the wealthy individuals, of course, got their big cuts in just two applications. One was the huge tax cut for the upper brackets in the Reagan administration, and then the second big one came in the George W. Bush administration, which together blew a big hole in the revenue stream into our country's treasury, and hence all the cuts in social programs since then, and education especially. So anyway, tax rates were cut on the corporations, and I thought what I'd see as part of this public discussion about wages would be this history around it. The fact that raising the minimum wage is a first step, but that nearly all wages have been suppressed for three or four decades. Clearly, what's needed is a widespread correction of the wage theft of recent decades. But no, instead, articles I happened to see on the subject were musings about whether capitalism inevitably ends up in a vast disparity between the richest sliver of the population and nearly everyone else. Well, Marx did observe that capital concentrates. So true. But only if a democratic society lets that happen via the laws and the tax structure it opts for. So this situation cannot be resolved morally unless we correct the way too low current tax rate for corporations and simultaneously have a grassroots demand to correct the wages after decades of wage theft. Of course, when President Obama talks about tax reform for corporations, this is not at all what he has in mind. Amazingly, he's thinking of making their tax rate even lower, as he has said repeatedly and done. In one speech, he said that the United States tax rate for corporations is terribly high compared to that of other nations, but he was comparing it to tax rates worldwide. If one compares it to our peers in the G7, our current corporate tax rate is definitely not high. In any event, I was pleased to see an article about this in the New York Times last Sunday with a very helpful chart and three graphs. And if you're involved with this issue, you might want to take a look online at this article. It's in the April 5th, 2014 issue of the New York Times. It's written by Floyd Norris, and the title of the article is Corporate Profits Grow and Wages Slide. And so in this chart, he shows administrations from the Hoover administration in the 1920s on up to our present day with the Obama administration. And through all those decades, the highest after-tax corporate profits occur in the Obama administration. And the effective corporate tax rate was highest in the Truman administration, right after World War II. We were paying off the huge war debt. Of course, we have two huge war debts to pay off now. But instead of doing it through taxation, they're just cutting social programs instead to balance the budget. And employee compensation, as you may have seen mentioned over the years, peaked around 1973. That was during the very last part of the Nixon administration. After that, it just flattens, and then it starts going down as a percentage of GDP. And also, an interesting column is change in the value of the S&P 500 index. This got the biggest total change in the Clinton administration. During those 8 years in the 1990s, it increased by 210%, the value of the blue chip corporations in the S&P 500. And I hope you all remember why that is. One of the main reasons was that Clinton had his U.S. EPA completely discontinue issuing any citations for pollution violations. Instead, a new program was put in place called Compliance Assistance, where if a company was dumping toxic waste into a river or the soil, the ground table, groundwater, an employee of the EPA would be sent out to talk to them and say, oh, perhaps you don't understand the law. Perhaps if I explain it to you better, you'd see that you really shouldn't be dumping all these toxic substances into the environment. So it was just wide open for pretty much no controls on pollution during that time, and there was a big increase in profits for the company who could just, as they say, externalize those expenses into the public's backyard. So, that was the biggest total change during an administration. But the biggest annualized change of the blue chips every year now is in the Obama administration, up 17.7% every year. Just cooking along now. None of that going into the wage correction. So I'm just hoping that this article will give people enough clear ammunition to talk about it in Washington and state legislatures with this historical framing, because it's not just something out of the blue. Oh, gee, there's a problem with the minimum wage, and oh, gee, I guess capitalism just naturally kind of does this. It does not have to be on automatic pilot like that, which has been completely manipulated, of course, by the big money interests. Anyway, one more thing before we go to our guest today. I received an email from 350.org asking everyone to spread the word about the first installation of a 9-part television program that will be shown this Sunday. The title is Years of Living Dangerously. And as 350.org describes it, it's a story of planetary proportions, the story of the climate crisis. It's produced by James Cameron, and it has some movie stars in it, so let's see if a Hollywood treatment of this mega issue can actually succeed in getting people's attention and getting some political action. Again, the name of the program is Years of Living Dangerously, and it starts this Sunday, April 13th, on the Showtime channel. Now, today we're going to hear about what happened and is still happening as we speak with the ongoing planetary crisis at Fukushima. My guest today is Gar Smith. He's the author of the book, Nuclear Roulette, The Truth About the Most Dangerous Energy Source on Earth. This was published in 2012. And it's really an excellent book, folks. He's a very fluid writer who's been able to weave this narrative about exactly what happened. He catches the suspense. He puts all the facts in, but you're just really carried along. I highly recommend it if you want to understand what happened. So he's also editor emeritus of Earth Island Journal, which is a very good environmental magazine I've read for decades. It comes out of Earth Island Institute in San Francisco. Gar is also a Project Censored award-winning investigative journalist. He is a co-founder of Environmentalists Against War and also a veteran of Berkeley's free speech movement. He has covered revolutions in Central America and has engaged in environmental campaigns on three continents. He lives in a low-impact, solar-assisted lifestyle, in Berkeley, California. Gar Smith, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Charlene, and welcome back on air. That was a marvelous opening commentary, by the way.
Oh, well, it's such a pressing situation for the people who've been so badly ripped off, but we'll see what can happen. So the mainstream media, I think, as far as I can tell, seems to be taking a pretty casual approach to informing the public about what's continuing to unfold at and out from the Fukushima nuclear reactors. You know, a couple of months they said, oh yeah, there was a problem with the valves. A couple of valves didn't work. So then they report that, okay, that's done.
Yeah, but
I don't think most people have a sense of the full situation. So in the first half of this program, I'd like to ask you to walk us through what happened at Fukushima in the wake of that 9.0 earthquake off the coast of Japan on March 11th, 2011, and the resultant tsunami.
Okay, you've set the parameters. That was the date, and that was the impact. The quake itself actually shut down 11 reactors at four different coastal nuclear sites. And the one that we focused on was Fukushima because that was where the Sendai tsunami came ashore and killed nearly 16,000 people. The water was very destructive and near apocalyptic. It still gives me chills, and it's unbelievable to look at even today on reviewing. But the quakes damaged the reactors at Fukushima. There were six reactors there. Four were online, two were offline for maintenance. And after the initial damage from the quakes, the water came over the protective seawall and flooded the basements. And the basements happened to be where the generators were that provided power for the cooling units and the lights for the plants. And with those systems out, they had to rely on emergency power. It was a very desperate time in there. Nobody really knew what was going on. The Japanese government originally downplayed the danger, while at the same time they were debating whether it would become necessary to evacuate Tokyo. They initially reported the radiation levels were only a tenth of those registered at Chernobyl, when in fact it was later found out that they were more than double the initial reactor release at Chernobyl. It took them 2 months. It took Tokyo 2 months to actually admit that there had been meltdowns at three of the reactors. And it's,
when you say Tokyo, do you mean the Tokyo Electric Power Company
actually,
or the government?
Tokyo, the government standing in for the government, and TEPCO itself.
Uh-huh.
There was a lot of close-to-the-best dealings on both sides.
Yeah.
And the aftermath explanation is always, well, we wanted to avoid a panic. We didn't want to alarm the public. And one of the ironies was that the Japanese government had created a special alert system called SPEEDY, that was designed to detect radiation and alert the public of the danger. But when the SPEEDY system went off, the government saw the readings were so high and alarming that they banned the release of the information to the public.
Oh.
It took a while for that information to come out, too. But one of the things that's not widely known is that there was nearly a fourth meltdown. There was a reactor at an adjacent facility. Actually, it was the Unit 5 facility at Fukushima. On May 28th, the pumps feeding the seawater into the plant for emergency cooling failed, and there was a dangerous rise in the reactor core and spent fuel pool temperatures. The workers labored for 15 hours trying to install a backup pump.
Hmm.
By the time they finally got it working, the core was within, they estimate, less than 7 degrees Celsius of a boil-off that would have led to a fourth meltdown.
Hmm. Wow. So, Gar, did we lose you?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
Just taking a breath.
What happened next?
Kind of a sobering moment there. I had to collect my my emotions.
I see.
There was a continuing cover-up by the government and TEPCO. The government response to the independent reports about the high levels of radiation was usually to either minimize or change the rules. It was an alarming story when the tap water at Tokyo schools was found to be contaminated with high levels of radioactivity.
Oh,
the government responded by raising the level of permissible radiation 20-fold.
Right.
This was such a shock to the radiation safety advisor in the government that he resigned in protest.
Oh.
But this was the standard response when food turned up to be radioactive. They just changed the acceptable level of radiation by a factor of 5.
Well, that was shockingly going on inside Japan, but there was also, by a certain point, reporting in the international press that they'd sent in people who were not trained and they had been exposed, and basically the idea that they didn't know what they were doing. And so the question that's arisen in my mind, and I know you'll get to this at the end of the program, but it's just, even from that early point where it seemed like they just couldn't cope and didn't know what to do next, why were these people still allowed to be in charge? I mean, why? I know international advisors flew in, but why didn't a whole international team of engineers and nuclear engineers and technicians take over? Because it was a planetary crisis, and yet it kept being left in the hands of this local electric company who was just floundering.
Yeah, literally. And why is that still the case?
Yeah.
Well, the reason that they were caught unprepared is that they had told themselves all along that this was something that couldn't happen.
Oh.
So when it happened, nobody had a clue. You'd open up your manuals for emergencies, and there wouldn't be a page on what was happening in Fukushima that day. If you really want a good insight into what it was like being inside the plant during those days, there's a new book that just came out. It's called Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. It was co-written by 3 scientists at the Union of Concerned Scientists. There's just one section here I'd like to read to give you a flavor of what it looked like from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
The book says, to operate the instruments that could provide the information the workers needed most, the water, temperature, and pressure levels inside the reactors, the engineers badly needed power. They thought they had one backup source left, emergency batteries. Soon, workers would be roaming the muck and debris-laden plant grounds, scavenging batteries from undamaged cars and buses in a desperate attempt to jury-rig some sort of power system. With the power out, the workers waded through flooded basements guided by flashlights. The waves had lifted metal grates out of position, so one false step could send a worker plunging down a 10-foot hole. At one point, these isolated workers, cut off from the rest of the world and fearing they would never survive, took a few minutes to write their names on the whiteboard in a control room. These workers were incredibly resourceful and daring. Unlike the management of TEPCO, the head of TEPCO phoned the prime minister in Tokyo and told him that the situation was so bad that he has decided to abandon the plant. They were just going to just vacate. He wanted to order everybody out. He was going to run for it.
Right.
And the folks in Tokyo realized that if this happened, the radiation could spread from Fukushima Daiichi to the next nuclear plant and then to the next nuclear plant, leading to one evacuation after another until Tokyo was overwhelmed with the resulting radiation. So the prime minister stormed into the office of TEPCO at something like 5 o'clock in the morning, and he threatened the guy. I will destroy this company if you don't stand and fight. And because of Naoto Kan's stand, Tokyo has not yet been evacuated. It could still happen, but he did put the brakes on at a very critical moment, and he's kind of one of the unsung heroes of
the story. So he's a hero like those workers who are just going up against great odds and not quitting.
Yeah. Real heroism. This is heroism beyond something you'd even see on a battlefield. It was a battlefield, but unlike anything that humans have ever dealt with before.
Mm.
And the battle continues.
So while this was happening, what was the response from our government, the United States?
Well, it was very similar in kind. The president let everybody know that there was nothing to worry about because the radiation plume would not even reach Hawaii. At the same time that we were getting these reassurances, the radioactive cloud was passing over Los Angeles, Seattle, San Francisco. It tipped over the Rockies and was detected in Boston. It took 18 days for it to circle all the way around the Earth.
Hmm.
And the government said not a word about the dangers. They have something called a RadNet system that's supposed to monitor atmospheric radiation. Turned out that many of the RadNet devices were offline or ineffective because of poor maintenance. And the government didn't have any comment about what their working monitors were detecting until after a team of students on a rooftop here at UC Berkeley put out some monitors and reported to the press that they were detecting unusual levels of cesium in the rainwater.
But see, when the government, why didn't the media press them on that? You know, where are the readings? Tell us the readings. I mean, do they not understand the issues?
Well, after the independent reports were issued by the student researchers, then the government, the EPA, started to respond.
Yeah.
But, of course, by minimizing the hazards. And one of the ways that they minimized this was to talk about iodine-133, which is poses a threat of lodging in the thyroid and causing thyroid cancers. And the line that you always hear is, this iodine isotope only has a half-life of 6 days, not to worry.
Mm.
But putting this in context, if you've got a source that is continuing to bombard you with radioactive isotopes for weeks at a time, it's not like it goes away after 6 days. The levels continue to rise for the first six days, and then they're at a plateau, and then they don't decrease until the source is no longer present. It takes 6 days to decline, and at that point, it's still a half-life to go. But no talk about the isotopes that have a half-life of 34 years or 300 years.
Was what happened a function of the design of the reactors? They were made by GE, and I remember decades ago when it was decided that GE's reactors had design flaws that could not be sold here, and they decided to dump them around the rest of the world, sell them elsewhere. Was this part of that?
Yeah, this was a made in America disaster. It was American influence that got those reactors into Japan. There was a lot of intrigue involved, including the CIA dealing with a Japanese publishing magnate who had dreams of a nuclear-powered Japan and publicized atomic power as a friendly power source for this island with limited energy resources.
Mm-hmm.
But GE has a long and, one might almost argue, a criminal career, given the warnings that have been issued over many decades about these particular plants. They were really a spinoff from the power plants designed for the nuclear navy under Admiral Hyman Rickover. Rickover even turned tail and condemned these reactors and wanted to see them destroyed as well.
Mm-hmm.
But a brief history of these warnings, going back to 1972, when we had the Atomic Energy Commission, which predated the NRC,
mm-hmm.
one of their officials strongly recommended that the designs called a General Electric Mark I, that these designs should be discontinued because they were inherently and unacceptably risky.
Mm-hmm.
And then comes 1975, three General Electric engineers appeared before Congress and explained why they quit their jobs. They had been working on the Mark I design, and they determined that it was so basically flawed that it could trigger an accident. And then in 1974, some ill-advised official at GE confided to an industry journal, Engineering News Record, that the Mark II containment vessel, quote, could be subjected to newly discovered physical loads that could structurally damage the steel containment.
Mm.
Then comes 1985. Four different nuclear operators who had bought these plants, these GE Mark I reactors, sued General Electric for fraud, misrepresentation, and breach of contract. And the judge in the case ruled that GE was guilty of hiding serious doubts about the safety of the reactor, and compared what the company had done to an instance of nuclear roulette. And they found some documents during discovery that showed that GE had been aware of this problem since 1958 and had engineers working trying to fix the problems all this time. And their overall strategy was that they would continue to promote the sale of these reactors because that they knew eventually they'd also get to be able to sell the correction to all of the people who had bought the flawed reactors.
Oh, wow, entrepreneurial innovation.
yes, indeed.
Okay, we have to pause here for a break, but oh boy, we'll be back with more. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Gar Smith, author of the book Nuclear Roulette. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Gar Smith, author of Nuclear Roulette. A lot of his articles are available at alternet.org and also at earthislandjournal.org. And I want to say, too, that one of the other hosts at PRN, Harvey Wasserman, has written a lot about this issue, and his articles are available at his Solartopia site, and other ones you can find by Googling him. Okay, let's get back here to what's happening with the cleanup operation, and also want to ask you when we get into this about an article I saw in the paper that cesium levels along a roadside in a California town are already detected as being high. But anyway, two things, you know, what's going on there now in terms of cleanup and what's going on in the Pacific and the Pacific Rim, which is the West Coast?
Yeah, it's quite a a dilemma. There's a land cleanup and a reactor cleanup and a sea cleanup, and nothing is going very well.
Mm.
They've got an area the size of Rhode Island, just in Fukushima province, prefecture rather, that they're slowly scraping clean, and they're bagging the topsoil and storing it and creating another storage problem. They've got all of this debris from the tsunami damage that's been contaminated from the atmospheric fallout. It's got to be collected. Standing buildings have been simply hosed down, swashing the radiation into the gutters. One of the plans for the cleanup involves clear-cutting forests and incinerating radioactive contaminated debris. There's so much radioactive debris, though, that you know, whenever you burn this stuff, it sends the radioactivity right back into the atmosphere.
Of course.
Not very wise, but Tokyo is plugged ahead with this ingenious statistical solution to the problem. They do have a limit. They say that you can't burn material that's too radioactive. So what they allow these companies to do now is they take their radioactive trash and they mix it with clean garbage that they've acquired from other sources, which allows them to bring the radiation average down to a legal limit that allows them to permissibly incinerate it and send the isotopes right back into the air and on the land.
Mm. Well, let's talk first. There are a number of things I want to get to. But when I was listening to you talk about all those nuclear engineers, the design engineers who, through an act of conscience, spoke out either in Congress or elsewhere about the faulty aspects of these designs of the GE reactors, they were talking about the design of the reactor itself. And when you combine that with the fact that a lot of them are located on the Pacific Rim in Asia and North America, where earthquakes and tsunamis happen, it just seems incredibly risky. So I'm wondering, you know, if you feel this could happen here, with either inland reactors or the ones that are left along the coast. Of course, the San Onofre reactor was closed last year south of L.A.,
mm-hmm.
but we still have a lot of other ones. So how safe are we?
Well, when it comes to the Mark I reactor specifically, that's one of the first reactors that was set loose on the land. And those little beasts should definitely be corralled and shut down and dismantled. They're just badly designed, small containment-sized reactors that, as we now know, the engineers warned about all along as being too prone to overheating, explosions, containment ruptures. Mm-hmm. And it turns out we've got 23 of them in the United States, mostly in the east, Midwest and east. And a lot of them, it turns out, are now at risk of earthquakes. The NRC had basically assumed that the earthquakes were a threat on the, you know, California coast. Well, they are. But it turns out that there's a lot of quake activity that the NRC had not been cognizant of when they did their initial findings that are well established throughout the Midwest and the Southeast. So a lot of these reactors are in danger not necessarily from earthquakes and tsunamis, but from earthquakes themselves,
mm-hmm.
and also from inland tsunamis, because an earthquake has the potential to damage many dams that are located upstream from reactors in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
This is a problem that some people have said is statistically more of a threat than what happened in Fukushima. And the NRC itself determined the level of this threat as being quite severe in a study that they did and then suppressed. And we would not have known about it had not the engineers involved in the report become whistleblowers and gone to the press.
Well, you know, I was interested after it happened in the different international reactions. Angela Merkel in Germany, of course, she said, oh, now I get it. Okay, we are getting off nuclear. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there's our country suppressing, you know, the reports and, oh, no problem. So I suppose the difference is that in Germany there was a strong anti-nuclear political presence, which was the entire Green Party and mm-hmm. sections of other parties. And over here, the Democratic Party hasn't really come out against it, so we don't have that strong political sector saying, yes, we've been urging you to get off of it, now can you see? So what did you think about the different reactions internationally to the crisis?
Angela Merkel's response was inspired. She is a former nuclear partisan, and if anyone yeah. was likely to be expected to continue to save the future of this technology, it would have been Merkel. But reportedly, when she saw those reactors exploding on television, she turned to an aide and said, "It's over." She may be a scientist, but she can put two and two together. Her response was really admirable, and it should be the gold standard for public response to this threat.
Yeah, called common sense.
Yeah, and their renewable energy program, as a result, has absolutely expanded beyond anybody's expectations. It's a model for the planet.
Yeah, they have a lot of solar, even with those gray skies, and we have the whole sun belt across the.
Yeah, at one point they
were part
even,
of our country. We're not really using what.
At one point, Germany was even exporting solar electricity to France, which is Europe's leading atomic country.
Yeah, right.
Atomic
uh-huh.
energy company.
Huh.
Meanwhile, in Japan, though, the successive prime ministers that came in after the plants exploded have started trending back towards support of nuclear power. While talking about renewables, the new prime minister, Shinzo Abe, has said that he's willing to see maybe 20% of the power budget produced by renewables, but he wants to bring nuclear back in a big way. He's already talking about opening up, reopening the Sendai reactors, and he's even talking about building a new reactor in Japan that will use mixed oxide fuels, which I think he's talking about the mixture of uranium and plutonium, which is a very controversial technology.
Mm.
So naturally, he's getting a lot of pushback from the anti-nuclear movement in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the plume that's moving across the Pacific from Fukushima, especially from that Unit 4 and the spent fuel?
Mm-hmm.
The radiation that's gone into the ocean, you say, or some people say, it's about to reach the West Coast. I mean, what does it already mean for seafood? And where is it now if it hasn't hit yet?
Yeah, there are a couple of studies on that to give a sense of what we're facing. In the first days of the reactor disaster back in 2011, there was seawater that was being used to cool the reactors because everything else had failed, and they didn't want to use seawater initially because they realized that it would corrode the reactors and make them unusable. Mm-hmm. Initially, the pro-nuclear folks didn't want to do that, but there was no other alternative, so the local plant manager basically, although he was ordered not to use the seawater, he said to one of his associates, "We're going to go on television now, and TEPCO's going to be watching, Tokyo's going to be watching, and they want me to carry out this order. And you say you're going to carry out the order. I'm going to tell you to carry out this order, but don't carry out the order. It's insane." So they went ahead and they used the seawater. But
and a good thing it was.
That's right. And they've been continuing to use seawater. And it's also been mixing with watershed drainage offshore. Mm-hmm. And this all floods the basements and gets radioactively contaminated, and then it gets pumped out, and if they don't do something with it, it flows into the Pacific. And mm-hmm. in the first days, they polluted nearly 100,000 square miles of the Pacific with the radioactive iodine, strontium, cesium at levels that were 300 times above normal. It still stands as the worst ocean contamination in world history. Mm. And every time there's a spill there, and there are always spills, water gushes back into the Pacific, and the water's not just offshore Fukushima, where the fishing industry has been vitiated, but it is pushed by the black current, the Kyushu current, up to the north, and then across down Alaska and the west coast. And according to there are two major studies that have been done. One is predicting that the plume would reach the coast of Alaska and Washington State in March of 2016. The other report predicts that it should be hitting our shores about now, April of this year. And, of course, there's been considerable concern about this and reports of declining populations of sea life, orcas and marine mammals. And the most worrisome report, I guess, was about the starfish wasting disease that has nearly obliterated the populations all along the western coast. That was of great concern to me, but I saw a report recently that pointed out that the starfish wasting disease was initially reported in 2008, well before the Fukushima disaster, so it could be that there are other problems that account for that, but certainly additional radioactivity in the ocean, no matter to what degree it is diluted, is still going to have an impact. And, of course, the impact is going to continue to aggregate as long as those reactors are sloughing their radioactive detritus into the oceans. And as near as we can tell, TEPCO has no strategy, no proven technology to contain this water, and that means that it will continue to flow into the ocean for decades, perhaps longer, continuing to raise and raise and raise the radioactivity of the seas at the same time that our fossil fuel burning continues to raise the carbon content of the oceans.
Yeah, the acidification of the oceans, and now the radiation.
So it puts us in a very bad position. And we already know that kelp off the California coast is proven to be contaminated with fallout, probably from the atmosphere, not from the ocean plume. And there was a case recently where bluefin tuna were hauled out of the ocean, and something like 15 out of 15 were found to be contaminated with radioactive cesium. It's hard to remediate a spill in the ocean.
Yeah.
You can't scrape the first 3 inches of topsoil off and bag it off to a plant in Nebraska.
Right. But that's why I wonder why it isn't, you know, on the front page of newspapers, at least a little box, here's what's happening this week, you know, with the ongoing planetary disaster at Fukushima. When it happened, I was still teaching then, and my colleagues, you know, just kind of regarded it as this unfortunate thing that happened in Japan. I said, it's not just an unfortunate thing that happened in Japan, it's a planetary event.
Yes.
I thought it was very frightening if you were at all paying attention, and I still think that. So I'm wondering, in light of it, has there been any kind of international reaction that would make some more constructive response in the future? In other words, maybe one of the reasons that an international force of experts and technicians didn't go in and say, you know, we're in control now, somehow the UN just getting Japan to agree to that, and you'll be glad we are because you don't know what you're doing, so really this is better for your country. is there any kind of organized team like that or structure for that to happen in the future?
The United States has sent scientists over to Japan. It did from almost the first weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But this was more of support nature. It wasn't, mm-hmm.
Making
directed.
Decisions.
Yeah, there are a number of ad hoc and NGO organizations, coalitions that have been calling for an international response. Last month there was a two-day conference in Texas by the individuals who are trying to motivate the world powers into seeing this as an international threat and responding appropriately. But so far it hasn't happened, and it seems to be one of these niceties of sovereignty when it comes to a nuclear disaster that threatens the globe. We respect sovereignty, but when it comes to a matter of whether we think people in the streets are being unduly threatened by their government, sovereignty is thrown to the winds, and we invade massively and take control of the situation. Maybe if our military responses are any indication, maybe it might even be a good thing that the United States didn't storm into Japan and try to take charge of things.
Well, no, I was thinking of something under the auspices of the UN, but I guess nothing's been set up. In other words, if this would happen somewhere else, would there be a different kind of coordinated international response right away?
Yeah, you'd think that the UN would be the agency. What else have we got? But the UN works with the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Uh-huh.
And it's not generally known, but even the World Health Organization they aren't free to independently critique nuclear power. They have to essentially pass all of their criticism by the International Atomic Energy Commission for clearance. So even the UN is not untainted by this tie to the nuclear powers.
Yeah. Really quickly, we have just about a minute left, but I do want to bring in this suit by the sailors who were on the USS Ronald Reagan ship,
mm-hmm.
which was brought in to assist, and they were within 2 miles of the Fukushima reactors when one of the meltdowns happened. Can you tell people about that briefly?
Yeah, unfortunately, if you're in the U.S. military and you suffer some kind of an injury because of you were just following orders, as they say, you're out of luck. You can't sue the government. So they're trying to sue TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, for a series of health problems that have been plaguing them ever since Reagan sailed into this white cloud of nuclear ash, and
right.
Sailors were instructed to go out on the deck without protective gear and start swabbing it down with mops. They tried to
and they immediately tasted something metallic, right?
Yeah, and that's most likely from what are called hot particles, and these are released from the explosions. It's not just radioactivity, but this is physical material that can be inhaled or ingested, and it lodges in the body, and it continues to emanate dangerous radiation as long as it's in the tissue.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is all the time we have. There's so much to be said here, and you've really done a great job in helping us understand the bigger picture going on here. So, Gar Smith, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for the opportunity to once again get this information out into the public ear.
Okay. Well, let's move over to the Arts Corner and see what we have for our poem this week. What with Earth Day coming up and the planetary implications of Fukushima we've just heard about, it's time for my favorite ecological wake-up poem. This is by Kay Ryan, a former poet laureate of the United States, from her collection entitled The Niagara River, which is also the title of this poem. As though the river were a floor, we position our table and chairs upon it, eat, and have a conversation. As it moves along, we notice, as calmly as though dining room paintings were being replaced, the changing scenes along the shore. We do know this is the Niagara River, but it is hard to remember what that means. How hard can it be, folks? For our song this week, well, I'm so glad to be back with all of you. Here's a song that starts out, "I'm so glad to be here tonight. I'm so glad to be home." Yep, this is a song written by Solomon Burke. It's performed here by the Rolling Stones in 1964. Everybody needs somebody to love. Here it is. That was the Stones with Everybody Needs Somebody to Love. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespratnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today on April 24th for my Earth Day program with John Grimm, co-author of a new book, Ecology and Religion. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.